Expert HR Weekly, compliance, good practice and benchmarking for UK HR professionals.
Hello and welcome to this week's Expert HR Weekly with me, Susan Dennehy. Having the right contractual documentation in place is essential to ensure that an overseas assignment runs smoothly, which should include what will happen if things don't work out and who will bear the cost of such things as accommodation and repatriation should the assignment be terminated. With me to explain the issues that employers need to consider when preparing for an overseas assignment and offer his invaluable practical advice, I'm delighted to be joined this week by employment partner at Morgan Lewis and expert HR author Matt Howes. Welcome to Expert HR Weekly, Matt.
Hello, good to meet you.
It's a big investment moving staff globally and expanding into other countries. Lots of overseas assignments fail. In your experience, what is the main reason for that?
I would say it's down mainly to lack of planning. I think what we often find is that the business gets very excited about sending someone overseas, sending someone to a new location maybe, or even to an existing location. And the business have got it in their mind that it's going to happen and it's going to happen quickly. And HR, in my experience, sometimes gets swept along as well and don't maybe put a brake on it and say, well, we need to think about some of these things, such as obviously the immigration, but equally important, tax affairs for the person. Where will they be taxed? Will there need to be tax equalisation? Benefits issues, will they remain in their home country's benefit plans, pension plans, for example, or will they step into the host company or host country's plans? And then obviously just the pure employment law relationship as well, in terms of the documentation of the contractual arrangements when that person is located overseas. So I'd say most of it failed because there isn't enough planning at the beginning of the whole process to think about what could happen in certain circumstances and to deal with important issues like, let's say, tax, maybe other things as well, family issues, accommodation, school fees. But it's, so I'd say, lack of planning, number one.
And you quite often see the company sending their star performer, perhaps their star IT person or salesperson, off to a country to take on the role overseas, and it doesn't work out that well and they're not performing that well. Is there anything the employer should put in place for that sort of contingency?
Yes, certainly. I think, again, you find that the excitement or the enthusiasm, if you like, for the assignment at the beginning, you find that employers and maybe the employee as well focus very much on starting out, what's going to happen, how much they're going to be paid, where they're going to live, etc. And they don't spend enough time thinking about what could happen if it goes wrong. So again, in the documentation, in the contractual documentation, there should actually be some quite detailed provisions I would recommend that deal with what happens in the worst case scenario where it doesn't work out. Again, the more detail you put into the agreement, the less uncertainty there is, and therefore the clearer, if you like, roadmap that exists at the end for the employer and the employee about what will happen, i.e. will there be a job to return to, or if not, what will my severance payment likely look like? Will my family and all my worldly possessions be flown home? And if so, who bears the cost? So again, the more certainty you put in the beginning, the less trouble and the less uncertainty there is going to be at the end if it does unfortunately go wrong.
As you say, I mean, it's quite an exciting time, even for the employee, and they might not want to raise what will happen if
exactly.
This doesn't work out. So really, it's the emphasis on HR, isn't it?
I would say so, yeah, absolutely. Just to, again, just to be the, I wouldn't say the killjoy necessarily, but just calm everyone down a bit and think about some of the more difficult issues, particularly what would happen at the end.
Because it can be quite drastic, can't it? If someone's gone to another country, they've moved their family, they've moved their pets.
It can be quite drastic from both a personal and a professional basis. So yeah, absolutely. So again, it's all about just trying to get as much clarity as you can so everybody knows where they stand. I think the cases I've been involved in where it gets the most traumatic is where there is very little in the agreement. And so the employee, as well as having to worry about returning home, getting their kids into school back at home, maybe their house has been rented out, they need to deal with things like that. And lastly, they need then is actually be involved in some pretty tortuous and maybe distressing negotiations with their employer about the financial consequences. So if that is sorted and that's in the agreement, they can then concentrate maybe on more of the soft personal side of things.
You sometimes see these employees put on like standard employment contracts and there's nothing about repatriation,
yeah,
or what's going to happen or the notice period or what's going to happen if the person's visa runs out. Is there anything the employer can do to prepare to clean up that mess just in case it doesn't work out? I know you've mentioned a few things there.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, and I think that's the big danger, is where the documentation isn't properly adapted. So what you'll find, and what we help a lot of our clients with, are bespoke documents to deal with the transfer of people or the assignment of people overseas. So more sophisticated employers will have a suite of documents that deal with all of these things. And so what will happen is that when the discussion is starting out about assigning someone overseas, a form will be given to the employee setting out this is how it will work very, very clearly. And it's, you know, that document is there and obviously has to be adapted from case to case because they'll often differ. But if you've got a suite of documents that you can use and don't have to draft things from scratch, that can certainly, again, provide clarity for everyone right at the beginning.
So having a proper contract in place with all the
Absolutely.
Contingencies covered.
So what you'll often find is in the case of a secondment where a person maybe is going for 2 or 3 years, they'll remain employed by their home company, if you like. What you will then have is that document may well stay in place, but it will be adapted. So you'll have a secondment letter which you will give to the employee, which will say, these are the terms of your employment arrangement, which are differing or changing rather, while you're overseas, and that will deal with remuneration issues, benefits issues, relocation issues, termination issues, and it will be a whole, effectively a new document which will exist, contractual document which will exist during the time that they are overseas. So it's very, I'd say it's dangerous just to rely on your normal type of employment contract. The only time I think you'd rely on a normal employment contract would be if you were doing not a secondment where the person remains employed by their home company, where there is a clean break, so it's actually a full transfer. So their employment's ending, say with the UK company, and they're starting a new employment relationship, say with the Singapore company, if they're being transferred to Singapore. And then you would just give them, in those circumstances where it's a permanent transfer, then you would just give them a local Singapore contract. But if you're doing a secondment where you're envisaging someone to return home, that's when you need to give a bespoke agreement which just deals with the relocation and deals with the terms and conditions while they're assigned overseas.
In terms of the going back to that, if it fails, in terms of a soft landing, often the employment's linked to visa requirements, etc. So it can be quite sudden and drastic for the employee. So any way the employer can organise a kind of soft landing for the employee?
Yes, and I think you're right. So immigration is a big issue. So in many countries, including the United Kingdom, the visa or the work permit that's been given to the employee is dependent on continued employment with that particular employer normally as well. So if you know in HR that it's going badly wrong and that the business wants to terminate the employment of the person overseas, one of the things you need to be saying to the business is, that's fine, but one of the consequences of that is going to be probably the withdrawal of their permission to live and work in that particular country. And so as part of the termination process, you need to make sure you put in enough time for the person to sort out their immigration issues and to return home. So what you'll often find is that although the person is maybe stripped of their responsibilities in this overseas country, you know, effectively they'll be put on garden leave, still employed, immigration status still exists, if you like, in that country, to give them time to sort out their return home, the return home maybe of their family as well.
There can be lots of costs involved, aren't there, for the employee, because they may, like as you say, may have rented out their own property, they may have rented a property in the country that they're in, they may have even changed their SIM card on their mobile phone, small technical things
Absolutely, and I think those costs are things that really should be, again, set out in your policy or in your particular contract, so that, again, there is no argument about who bears the cost. So often you'll find, you're right, housing is often a very expensive cost for the employer, effectively rent, take out a lease, because often the employer will be able to take out a lease in a country and the employee won't, because the employee doesn't have a record in that country, if you like. So that the landlord will insist that it's the employer takes out that lease. You then 3-year lease, say, you then terminate someone after 18 months. Who bears the cost of those outstanding 18 months worth of rent? More often than not, it will be the employer. And what you tend to say, though, is that it will be the employer unless the employee has been terminated for cause. So if it's just because the employee has underperformed or has been a falling out, maybe, or just culturally hasn't worked, well, that wouldn't be for cause. So then in those circumstances, the employer would pick up the cost. But if the employee is being terminated for a misconduct type issue, so maybe bribery or harassment or some other form of bullying or something like that, well, in those circumstances, you may then try and turn it around and say, well, it's your fault that your employment's ended. It's not the employer's fault, and therefore you, the employee, may have to pick up some of the outstanding costs. So again, that's the sort of detail I would recommend you start putting in agreements. So again, that there's no argument about who picks up the cost in certain circumstances.
Quite a lot of detail is going to take on quite a lot of time, but you're going to save an awful lot of time and probably money.
I think most assignment letters that I see now will run to several pages. If they don't run to several pages, it may be because they will then just refer to a separate document, which is the relocation policy. So again, so you sort of incorporate the relocation policy, but it's going to be pages. Absolutely. There's a lot to cover.
Looking at recruiting for the overseas post, presumably there's a number of things you should look at, like having the right qualifications, but what other considerations should employers think about when you're sending somebody abroad, particularly if you're sending them to a problem country like Saudi Arabia because of the laws there that may not be ones that people are used to, or dangerous countries? What considerations should employers have?
In my experience, you'll find that employers will look to send people who they consider to be the most adaptable, resourceful, and again, some sophisticated employers will actually maybe do some form of psychometric testing to bring out those qualities from people, check that those qualities existed within their own workforce, and then decide that they're the people to send. Other employers just are reacting maybe to circumstance and need to send someone quickly, and maybe don't think about those sort of things as much. But I think resourcefulness and adaptability are the ones that I think you'll find are the skills that most successful people working overseas will have. In terms of things like problem countries or more challenging countries, obviously those skills are even more important. I think the thing I've found sometimes employers fall into the trap of doing, though, is sort of making assumptions about people, particularly stereotypical assumptions about whether certain people with certain maybe protected characteristics from an Equality Act perspective, whether they will be able to work successfully in certain countries. So, for example, maybe making an assumption that someone who is homosexual, for example, would not be able to flourish in countries where homosexuality may be illegal or culturally viewed very badly. I think that's very dangerous for an employer to make those type of stereotypes or to make those assumptions, because that would mount to direct discrimination. And so effectively, I think what you need to be doing in those circumstances is to assume that all of your employees would be able to work in all of your locations, and almost allow the employees to self-select and say, I wouldn't be comfortable working in this country because of the maybe racism, or this country because of their views in relation to homosexuality, or even this country because of their views in relation to females working, for example. So you shouldn't make any assumption. You should maybe let the employee self-select in those circumstances.
And probably have an honest conversation with them. If you're sending a homosexual member of staff, you would have to sit them down, wouldn't you, and explain.
Give them some form of cultural awareness, absolutely. But again, I've had cases where, as I say, employers make assumptions and have not allowed people with certain characteristics to go to certain places. And that is very dangerous, particularly when subsequently what happens is maybe you say to someone in a redundancy round, we're selecting you for redundancy because you're not as flexible, or maybe you don't have as much overseas experience as someone else. And then the employee comes back and says, well, the reason I don't have as much overseas experience is because you didn't allow me to go to those countries. And that then becomes a problem. That becomes litigious. And as I say, I've had cases arising in exactly those circumstances.
And you said there that staff often select themselves for these overseas roles. Sometimes there's pressure on the employer, isn't there, to send people off because it's seen as a passport to Korea. And a lot of companies, they do say, we want you to go around two or three countries, and that's how you'll get into senior management. What are the benefits to the employer of sending somebody from their own company rather than taking a local hire?
I think what clients say to me, the reason for doing it is maybe two or three reasons. One is what they would say is that they're exporting their business's culture. So particularly a lot of businesses now, particularly maybe in the technology sector, for example, are very proud of their culture and their way of doing things. And if you send people who are imbued with that culture, that's about spreading that culture overseas. Similarly, spreading knowledge and expertise in particular products or particular areas of growth. But again, you're sending someone to be an evangelist almost to overseas and to spread that knowledge, spread that expertise. Obviously, the downside of that is that maybe they will not have the local knowledge and the local contacts. So I think what you'll find is that the most successful businesses will have a mixture of people in those circumstances. They'll send one of their long-serving maybe employees overseas so they can export their culture, but at the same time, they will employ people locally, so that you've got the local knowledge and the local cultural awareness too.
With a lot of countries, cultural awareness is quite big, isn't it, in business, if you look at countries like Hong Kong and China.
Absolutely. That reminds me always of an advert by an international bank that talks about understanding local culture and local business needs. And I think that's absolutely true.
So you've spoken before about the types of arrangements that people are sent on these assignments. Can you just remind us what the three main ones are?
Sure. So the most common by far, I would say, is the secondment, which lends itself to an assignment which is maybe 6 months, maybe to 2 or 3 years in length. And that's where, from a legal perspective, the person remains employed by their home company and are effectively loaned to the local company that they're going to work for in that region. So the whole idea then is that they will return to their home company, although whether what type of job they can return to varies from time to time. But secondment is the most common, and it's quite popular with employees because employees want to maintain a link with their home company. The second one is one I touched on a bit earlier, which is this where you have the clean break, again, where you're effectively sending someone for an indefinite period, a long period where the break, their employment relationship with their home company is completely broken, and they start a brand new employment relationship with their new company in the new country. And then the third, which you see increasingly, particularly for large multinationals, is what you see called sometimes the general employment company, where effectively all cadre, all the group of executives who are expected to work internationally and will work 3 years in Singapore and then go to Rio de Janeiro and then go to Dubai, and that's their career. They will then tend to be employed by a separate company within the group of companies, which will often be incorporated in a very tax-efficient country, such as Bermuda or Singapore, for example. And then effectively what happens is they're employed by that company, that's their employment relationship, and then they have a series of secondments from that general employment company to the different countries that they go to. And again, that sort of deals with the whole issue of, you know, there's no termination of employment and then starting a new employment. They're always employed by the general employment company. That can work very well, but it is very expensive to set up because obviously it involves you setting up a whole new infrastructure to deal with that. But once you've got it set up, it can be a very effective way of dealing with that group of employees.
And in terms of keeping an eye on the employee in your overseas operations, what do most companies do? Do they have an internal HR function, or do they tend to outsource their operations?
I think there's definitely a trend, I would say, to employers who have a lot of overseas assignments to either setting up a separate unit, which they may call global mobility or something like that, within their HR department, or giving particular responsibility to one or two people within their HR department. You're responsible. So they build up an expertise, and I think that's quite important that they do, that it is someone who builds up an expertise and understands the tax issues, the immigration issues, the benefits issues, the employment law issues, and maybe some of the softer family type issues as well. So I think that's a trend I'm seeing, is sort of more of a specialisation in this area in many HR departments.
And there are any rules, particular rules about dealing with performance or disciplinary matters for the overseas person? Does it tend to be the host country or the home country or
mixture? That really varies, and you'll find that, again, that's something that should be dealt with in the documentation. So I've found that many employers will hand over the employee to the host country and say they're subject to those rules and those performance measures. But again, I've seen other arrangements where actually the home company still maintains an interest and a control on that. So the one thing to remember, though, is that in most cases, once you go beyond 2 or 3 months, an employee will start to gain local employment law rights, so statutory rights. So if you are, for example, going to discipline someone who's overseas, you should be, as well as taking maybe advice in your home company or home country, you know, so in, say, in the UK, take legal advice in the UK about that person, but you should probably also be taking some advice in relation to the employment laws that may apply to the employee in their host country as well.
It must be very difficult to organise if you've got an outsourced operation to know how the company would want to deal with certain issues like
absolutely.
That.
There needs to be a lot of communication, absolutely. Everyone needs to be involved, home, host, management, the management line of needs to be involved as well to make those types of decisions.
Thank you, Matt, for that extremely useful guidance and helpful advice.
It's been a pleasure.
There are more resources on our website under the International Manual section in the Guide for Global Employers. That brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR Weekly, which you've been listening to with me, Susan Dennehy. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.
Expert HR Weekly, the latest from experthr.co.uk, the award-winning subscription service for HR professionals.